Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I appreciate everyone joining us on this first week of May, on this first weekend of May, and everybody who is tuning in to the website and on the podcast throughout the week, as, hey, I continue to be very busy trying to keep everybody as informed as possible on what's happening in these markets. Just a quick reminder, I have a webinar coming up next week with TriStar Gold. It's an exploration company focused in Brazil with a more advanced project and recently just struck a funding deal with Royal Gold. You can find sign-up links throughout the website. I'm kicking off the show with Mike Larson. He's the editor of the Safe Money Report. And Mike, let's start off with U.S. equity markets. However, I want to look at some of these other assets that you have been writing about. You even tweeted about it a couple days ago that outlined a number of important asset classes that are right at this decision point. So they have rallied off of that bottom, that washout bottom, just about a month and a half to 2 months ago. And now at these decision points, it's a crucial time for the markets broadly and these asset classes to see if they're going to break out or if they're going to turn back down. Please share with us some of the assets that you are watching at these crucial levels.
Sure, happy to do so. Obviously, most of us follow the stock market first and foremost. And if you look at something like the S&P 500, I mean, we've rallied, you know, we've had one of the strongest couple-week rallies that we've had in decades, frankly. But all we've done is get back to that 2,900 or so level on the S&P 500, which is essentially halfway back and about where some key levels going back even 2 years. This level has either served as resistance or support, depending on whether we're above or below it. And so now we're at kind of the decision point, you know, is this just a bear market rally or is this really signaling that there is a turnaround in the underlying economy? And frankly, I think if you look at the data, it remains incredibly dismal. I mean, whether you're talking about the fact that more than 30 million Americans in just 6 weeks have filed for jobless benefits, or the fact that GDP just shrunk by at a 4.8% rate, and that only included, that was the first quarter of this year, so it didn't even include most of the virus impact, which obviously started really hitting hard in the latter half of March. The data, again, is not indicating that there's much of a turnaround brewing, even some of the early April figures we've gotten so far. And yet the market's really pricing this V-shaped recovery. So in stocks, that's kind of what you're watching here. You know, how does this rally behave? How does the S&P 500 behave now that it's gotten back to this very important level? But as you pointed out, it's not just stocks. If you look at something like copper prices, I mean, we call it Dr. Copper for a reason. Copper is a good economic indicator simply because the metal is used in so many different parts of the economy. And it's just rallied back. It's had a relatively anemic rally back to resistance. You look at some foreign currencies against the U.S. dollar, and it's the same story, rallying back to resistance and where we originally broke down in March. So again, kind of across the board, and even interest rates I'd throw into the mix, are all at these key levels where either they're going to signal that this is about it for a bear market rally, in which case we need to be prepared for, at the very least, probably a retest of the lows or something similar to that. Or if we are able to bust through here, it would signify that, you know, something more is going on. This isn't just a bear market rally. This is truly a sign that, you know, all the stimulus being thrown at the economy, plus the gradual reopening of certain counties and certain states, is going to help things get better from here. I tend to be in the skeptical camp. We've talked about some of the problems the markets and the economy had before this coronavirus crisis even really hit us. And those factors haven't gone away. Those things haven't gone away, despite, you know, everybody's attention being rightly focused on the direct impacts of the virus. So, you know, put me in the skeptical camp, but I definitely think you want to be watching very closely here because, again, this is sort of a decision point. This is a crossroads, whatever metaphor you want to use. And either we're going to bust through or this is going to be the part where you might want to put on short positions or inverse ETFs or go ahead and sell some of the stocks and other assets that, you know, were really killing your portfolio a month ago, but now you've gotten higher prices that you can get out of them at better levels.
So this decision, I think, is going to have to be made fairly soon as we just turn the calendar month over to May. And quite frankly, because so many of these assets have rallied back to this resistance level or technical levels that, if they break through, again, it kind of adds to that bullish picture. Do you see any of these sectors, though, diverging from this general trend where it seems like a lot of different asset classes are positively correlated right now?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I did mention that interest rates are behaving interestingly, if you'll pardon the pun. They have tended to be the thing that has not confirmed the exuberance we've seen in equities or the strong bounce we've seen, off of other levels, particularly in sectors like tech and so on. So I think if you see interest rates continue to essentially go nowhere, go sideways, or in some cases actually drop a little bit, that's really telling you that the bond market doesn't believe, so to speak, what the equity market is telling you. And that would be a concerning development. If we continue to see interest rates falling or moving sideways, even as stocks attempt to break out, that's really a non-confirmation. And if you go back and look at the pre-virus environment, one of the big things that told me, you know, you want to be more defensive and you want to be more cautious is that the interest rate market, I mean, 10-year yields in the U.S., topped out in the fourth quarter of 2018 and then began a long, slow slide lower, even as people were saying the economy was in great shape. So in other words, the interest rate market was telling you we were already likely heading into a slowdown for the economy, probably what I would call a garden variety recession. And then obviously you layered this enormous downside pressure of the coronavirus on top of that. And that's why we're in this messy situation that we're in now. So again, I think I would keep an eye on that. And I would keep an eye on the stocks that really a lot of people have been hiding in. I mean, if you look at what's been holding the S&P 500 up, even as a lot of sectors, whether it's energy, whether it's financials, whether it's industrials have been lagging, it's really tech. It's a handful of mega cap tech companies, you know, your Microsofts, your Amazons, your Apples, and so on. They've been what's held the market up. If you lose any of those, you know, those few handful of stocks that are really propping up the averages, given their outsized market cap and outsized influence on those averages, then we're really in trouble because, again, you don't have a lot of other horses that are, so to speak, that are pulling this thing along. It's really just a handful of big cap tech names.
Yeah, that's so true. But some of these big cap tech names came out with some pretty good earnings this week, but that also goes on the back of a lot of people, I think, being stuck at home. So who knows how long we're still going to be stuck at home for. This is a similar question that I asked to a lot of guests throughout the week, and it deals with understanding that, yes, the economy in the U.S., around the world, literally everywhere, the economy is struggling, and the assumption is it's going to continue to struggle for another at least couple months, maybe through the whole year. However, markets, yes, in the face of that, have moved up, and we can all say that markets are forward-looking, and that's maybe why they were moving up. They thought that the economy would get restarted quicker, but there's also this underlying Fed put or central bank put that we heard from some key central banks this week that said they're going to remain easy for the foreseeable future. How do you balance these two out when you can understand that much more money created does land in markets?
I think there is a common assumption that the Fed can, or not that just that the Fed will try and prop up markets, but that they will 100% succeed at it. And we've seen in the past that isn't necessarily true when you're in a bear market trend. If you go back to the 2000 to 2003 cycle, or even 2007 to 2009, it's not like the Fed just sat there and didn't do anything while the markets fell and the economy deteriorated. The Fed was actively cutting interest rates sharply throughout both cycles. And then obviously in the last cycle, they were also throwing loads of QE at the market. Ultimately, you know, the market didn't bottom until the S&P 500 was down 50% in the first case and 57% in the second. Even at the worst levels in March, we were down only about 30 or some odd percent from the peak. So if this is a bear market rally, and if we've gotten about all we're going to get in terms of the bounce from the Fed, then this is a logical place where that rally would fail. That's why I'm definitely watching here. The other point I think I would make, again, is that the Fed itself, even when announcing all these programs, and even when Powell was giving his most recent virtual press conference, he admitted that they don't think this is going to be a quick V-shaped recovery. The Fed's operating on the consensus or the assumption that this thing is going to take months and months and months before we work through all the challenges. That's very different from what the stock market's pricing in here. If you look at the vigor of the bounce off the March lows, it really points to or has left us with this huge dichotomy between what the economic data is saying and what the markets are saying. And not only that, you know, you mentioned that markets are forward looking, and that's true. They tend to bottom before recessions end. But this is really, really putting the cart before the horse because of the vigor of the rebound and the amount of optimism about how strong that's going to be, which again is opposite of what even Wall Street's own economists are saying, and even opposite of what the Fed itself is saying.
Yeah, that's very true. Hey, we got to wrap it up here, Mike. We're out of time for the radio, but it's always great having you on the show. I appreciate you taking time to kick off the weekend edition. Have a great rest of your weekend. Everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back.
Thanks, Corey. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm chatting in this segment with Chris Temple, founder and editor of The National Investor, and I think well known to all of you, our listeners, as Chris joins me regularly throughout the week. I did want to bring Chris on this weekend show, though, because we're not going to focus, well, at all on kind of day-to-day movements of these markets. I want to take a bigger picture look at the currency system and our overall financial system. Because, Chris, I think it was about a week and a half ago that I had a discussion with somebody saying that, look at all the debt that's in the U.S. and it's finally going to matter now. And with all the easiness and all the money printing that the Fed is doing, it's going to lead to a dollar collapse, the end of the U.S. dollar being the world reserve currency. This whole saying of the death of the dollar is going to be here, all thanks, again, to central bank easiness and the economy essentially crashing or being shut down. But I didn't take that view. I took the view that you need to compare what's going on with all these other central banks. And quite frankly, I've heard time and time again that the financial system is going to collapse and the dollar is not going to be looked at the same way that it has been over the last, well, really century. What are your thoughts when you hear this argument of the death of the dollar?
Well, as I have told people numerous times, any of these Pied Pipers of the Gold Bug Echo Chamber or other scaremongers that are out there telling you these same things today, Corey, that the U.S. dollar is going to get dumped by the rest of the world because the Fed's printing too much money. It's going to cause gold to go to the moon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't walk away, run, because they have utterly no idea how currency markets and markets generally work in the year 2020. The best I can say is that they are, it's like they fell asleep in 1980 or else they got into a tricked out DeLorean and they set the flux capacitor for the year 2020 and poof, they're dumped in 2020 and they see the Fed printing all this money and oh gee, that means that the world's going to dump the dollar is going to go in a toilet. I just sent you a chart showing that the value of the trade weighted dollar has spiked higher because of all of the upheaval of the recent past and is now at its highest level since the mid-1980s, folks. And that's because in relative terms, the dollar is the best of a bad lot. It's the most liquid of a bad lot. And if anything, what is going to cause people to go away from the dollar, and you're hearing some of these things today, like we heard in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, where for a spell you had a spike higher in the U.S. dollar, that's killing everybody. Because the world over, you've got somewhere between $10 and $15 trillion between governments and corporations and various other entities of dollar-denominated debt that is increasingly harder to service these days with what's going on in the world, let alone ever pay off. So it is not a weaker. Look, Corey, if the U.S. dollar did start to go down in value, you would have global markets cheering, not saying like they are right now with the dollar higher and on a trade-weighted basis, its highest in a very, very long time, saying that this strong dollar is killing us. So, you know, some of these discussions, kind of like were frozen in the late 70s, around 1980, are just totally ass backwards versus how the world works today.
Now, what about even a step further than this? And I know we're going away from both what you and I think is actually happening and going to happen, but the collapse of the financial system going to maybe some asset-backed currency.
Well, look, there's a lot of different things being discussed, all right? And I have said for a long time now that when the end comes for the dollar as the world's reserve currency, it is likely to be, number one, because we had a monstrous spike that choked off growth and threw the world into a depression first, number one. Number two, it's going to be a part of the move that is already underway away from globalization to where the dollar may continue to have hegemony in our hemisphere. But in other parts of the world, you may have the Chinese yuan one day. I don't know if what's left of the euro will survive in Europe, but at least in that context, it probably will, etc. So I don't know that you're going to have one single overarching currency take its place in academic circles and in market circles, because that's all those people worry about. Yeah, you've got a lot of talk again, and again, largely because of the dollar strength. Over having some kind of overarching asset-based currency. You got the usual suspects with their nonsense of, you know, the IMF's special drawing rights are going to replace the dollar. Again, run away from people like that. Don't walk, run. But, you know, I think you're going to have a more disjointed situation. And finally, and I'll throw this in, lest anybody wonder where I'm coming from and my motivation, it won't bother me the least. I will be the first to lead a party and dance on a dollar's grave when that time comes that the dollar does not hold overall sway in the world, not because it's going to make gold go up. And frankly, when that day comes, it is going to be brutal for U.S. citizens and consumers who will see their standard of living deteriorate rapidly if the dollar is not the world's reserve currency. But the good part of it is, chances for peace breaking out in the world will be much better if the dollar is not the world's reserve currency. And that's a whole different discussion.
That is a very different discussion, but it does tie in. And I think that's a key to understand. That's one of the things that I'm, in a way, not hoping for, this whole death of the dollar or even death of the financial system, because, yeah, it's people in North America that our lives are going to change drastically and not for the better, as much as you hate big government. And hey, I'm in that boat too. I do not like big gov, but fact of the matter is, if the death of the dollar does happen, our way of life is going to change a lot. Now, one thing that has really brought up this discussion is central banks and their move now to even easier monetary policy, really for an indefinite period of time. But you also sent me this chart that outlines central bank balance sheets as a percent of GDP. As much as people want to focus on the Fed and why the Fed printing money is going to hurt the dollar, yada, 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 all these other central banks are printing money arguably to a greater extent. And you look at the Bank of Japan, the ECB, they have much higher percentages of central bank balance sheets than GDP. How does this all factor into your outlook?
Well, and again, and that's the point. You know, I listened to a guy the other day give a presentation. Again, it's like he was stuck, you know, in the late 70s or around 1980, which was a very, very different world. In the 70s, you know, when the U.S. was the first major economy out of the box to go to a totally fiat currency unbacked by anything. And historically, we know that that, you know, pivotal time came when President Nixon closed the gold window. Now, up to that point, the average American had no ability to turn in their Federal Reserve notes for gold, but for international accounts to be settled, there was an ability on the part of foreign investors and central banks to swap quote, paper dollars for simplicity's sake, for gold. And too many of them started doing it and basically called the Fed's bluff in those days to the, you know, Charles de Gaulle famously threatened to, you know, lead a global run on the Fed, and for a while actually started to do that, to the point where Nixon had to close the gold window and say, forget it, we don't have the gold. You know, now we're changing the rules. We're going to have a totally fiat currency. Gold is no longer a monetary asset as far as the central government is concerned. That's when gold went back to a market-oriented asset in 1971. And we know what's happened since then. Now, what was the case, Corey, in the 70s, is that it was basically the U.S. was the only one doing that. And so that's why when everybody else was still in relative terms, especially running far sounder currency policies than the U.S. suddenly was, that's why the dollar in the 70s went down. That's why inflation went up. That's why interest rates later went up and so forth. But today, everybody else is doing it better than we are. You know, but through the end of March, the Fed's balance sheet, which if we all know has popped up again recently, was, and I'll use round numbers, you know, to account for what's gone on in April, it was about 30%, 31% of GDP. The European Central Bank is pushing 50% of GDP. The Bank of Japan is well over 100% of GDP, its balance sheet, and all the money it's printed. So in relative terms, you know, the dollar is the best of a bad lot. And as I was talking to a colleague recently, when he was telling me the same thing you just did, he was trying to have a friendly discussion slash argument with someone with the same pitch. You know, the Fed's going to print so much money, the dollar is going to crash. And in fact, the opposite is actually happening right now. Hopefully we have time to talk about that. But this guy's response to his friend was the same as I say. What is the dollar going to go down against? When we're talking at least where fiat currencies are concerned. Now, as we've seen, the dollar will continue to go down against gold, less so than some other currencies perhaps, for the most part. But as far as other currencies, and this really dopey idea that people are peddling, again, some mean well, some it's the same old sales pitch of the world's going to dump dollars. No, again, the world is being choked by the strong dollar right now, which is still in very short supply in some ways. There's a very large global short position effectively of dollars. What would help the rest of the world and take the steam out of the renewed calls for the dollar to be replaced in one form or another is if the Fed were really to go nuts, add another zero to all of the quantitative easing, and push that dollar value back down, you know, notably. That would take the pressure off everyone. But I continue to say, for a lot of reasons, Corey, that if there is a surprise move to come in a near term for the dollar, it's going to be a spike higher that's going to rip people's face off and take everybody by surprise.
Well, I think even recently that is showing. The dollar has been moving higher, selling off a little bit at the end of the week. But hey, this dollar has been a lot stronger than all of these bears have wanted it to be. One other aspect of this argument, though, does deal with debt. And, well, debt, obviously, it is an issue. Debt just continues to grow. But again, my argument is this is a comparison game. And it seems like all these other countries are growing debt equally as fast. I know that's not the actual case, but everyone's growing debt. So why all of a sudden now is debt going to cause the collapse of the system?
Well, it's not per se. You know, the reason why interest rates have been compressed to nothing, and in some cases less than nothing, the European Central Bank with its new credit facility is loaning money to commercial banks at minus 1% this week. So, you know, when you look at the mathematics of how a fractional reserve system works, as I've discussed numerous times, you get to this place where more and more debt being issued and taken on gives you less and less traction as far as actual economic activity is concerned. It's why we need the system to be radically overhauled. And there's going to be several different elements as to how that is going to be done someday. But as far as maintaining the status quo, yeah, there's going to be a lot of new debt issued. That's the problem. We should be issuing, in my opinion at least, social credit apart from the Federal Reserve. The people should not have to be borrowing their own, quote, wealth and earning power and et cetera. That's, again, a different discussion for a different day. But, you know, as far as the debt is concerned, look, if you and I were talking 40 years ago, Corey, the U.S. government's debt was approaching its first $1 trillion. The dollar was going down. Interest rates and inflation were up in double digits. If I had told you that in 40 years that debt would go from $1 trillion to $25 trillion and be growing at its fastest rate ever, yet, the stock market will be 25 or so times higher. Inflation will be a fraction of what it was then. Interest rates will be a fraction of what they were, and people would be fighting over buying 30-year government debt at 1% or 2%. You'd have called Happy Acres and had him send the rubber truck for me. So going from $1 trillion to $25 trillion of debt hasn't cooked our gooses quite yet. I don't know how much farther we're going to go, but even though it means the stratification of wealth and a lot of other things because of the way our system is, they can keep Wall Street and these credit markets alive a lot longer than most people thought. And there were some smart people back in that day, you know, in the late 70s and into the early 80s, who were warning that the U.S. was about to go the way of the so-called banana republics in those days, the Latin American countries with triple and quadruple digit inflation rates. But the Fed figured out, none too soon, how to have the massive inflation that had to come not translate into Main Street type inflation as people thought it would. But that is where we've had the hyperinflation on and off since that time, in asset valuations of different kinds, in debt levels of different kinds, etc. One of these days, Humpty Dumpty won't be able to be put back together. But this has gone on for a lot longer than people thought. And again, to wrap it up, dollar-denominated debt in comparison to the rest of the world is not the first thing people should be looking at when they question the long-term health of the dollar. It's actually much stronger than the other currencies and is likely to remain that way for a while, if not get a lot stronger, especially if these quasi-recoveries we've had in stock markets and stuff don't hold. We go into a weaker economic time, then you're going to have a horrible doom loop of people scrambling for liquidity. The dollar goes up, that causes more stress and more scrambling for liquidity, that causes scarcer dollars to go up even more, etc.
All right, Chris, we're wrapping it up there. I enjoy having these conversations, especially with you, and sharing them on the weekend show because, as I mentioned, day over day, we do focus a lot on short-term market moves, trying to take a longer-term perspective, but these overarching themes are critical. And hey, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, there were a lot of comments that came in, so I wanted to get you on the show and get your take on all of this. So hey, I hope this clears it up. I know a lot of our listeners don't agree with this outlook, but curious to read over all of those comments as well. Chris, thanks for taking time on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that conversation I just had with Chris Temple. And on the back of that whole discussion on maybe the financial system being under a lot of pressure and currencies, especially how they are all functioning to each other, I think this next topic that I'm chatting with Mark Chandler about is crucial. Now, Mark is the managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. And Mark, it's a relatively new development, but an article that came out of the Washington Post just a couple days ago stated from Trump that he knows the virus came out of a Chinese lab. Now, there's a lot of other and conflicting stories to this. That's not really the crucial part here. The more crucial part is tensions building between the U.S. and China. It was really what dominated headlines last year was this trade war. And then at the end of the year, some optimism that a trade war or trade deal was getting done. We saw a phase one trade deal. But now this renewed tension on a completely different front between the U.S. and China, this could be just another, well, almost explosion waiting to happen. Give us a little recap on what you think could come out of this new conflict here.
Yes, sure. So what happened is in the Washington Post, they reported that the White House is thinking about ways to retaliate against China for this coronavirus. Now, all along, President Trump has been trying to blame China. In fact, there wasn't the G7 failed to have a communique, issue a communique after a recent meeting because the U.S. was insisting on calling it a flu, somehow whether it's a Wuhan flu or the Chinese flu. They were really trying to single this out. And it's controversial, I'd say at the least, but the important thing is that the U.S., Trump had said, separate from the article in the Washington Post, is when the president said that he knows, he's got evidence to suggest that the virus actually came out of a lab, which is part of this conspiratorial story all over the internet. And so the important thing for investors is the U.S. is thinking about retaliation. Now, many other countries in Europe have been talking about, and Australia too, talking about an investigation. And it is disappointing that China is rebuffing and not participating with the World Health Organization inquiry into the origins, because understanding the origins could help get us a vaccine. But the U.S. already has decided that China's at fault, and they're thinking about retaliation. And so the retaliation could be some things like, for example, U.S. pension fund, government pension funds, have a choice of different equities to invest in. Like many people are familiar with these sort of Chinese menus of how you should have your 401k money invested if your company gives you the 401k. And the government pension funds give the participants an offering that includes emerging market stocks, which includes China. So the U.S., the federal government could say, no longer will we give our employees access to this kind of fund. I think it has minimal impact on the big flows, capital flows around the world, but it's a possibility. Second thing is that China, as being a sovereign, it's difficult to sue them in a court of law. It's like a U.S. court. The U.S. has talked about suspending that, denying China that immunity from being a sovereign. And that's sort of a sword that cuts two ways, because the U.S. also benefits from being a sovereign and not having been caught up in all these court cases all around the world. But there is a possibility that was discussed in the Washington Post article. But the third thing, and this is what is catching people's attention, I think, is that made a suggestion that maybe the U.S. would default on some of the debt that China owns of the U.S. That is to say, the U.S., China owns at least $1 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries. From the U.S., this is the U.S. Estimate from the U.S. Treasury Department. And so the idea would be that if we can't get China to pay us, to compensate us for the economic hit from the COVID crisis, for the lives lost, maybe we can just not pay them what we owe them. This is an incredibly controversial issue, as you can imagine. It raises all kinds of questions. Quickly, though, the president's advisor, a top economic advisor, Kudlow, denied it. But in some ways, the mere fact that it was discussed, or that enough people think it was discussed, already is having a market impact. For example, even though, you know, China today, May 1st, is closed for the May Day holiday, it'll be closed the next couple of days. But the markets, as you know, have invented a parallel currency, an offshore RMB. And that offshore RMB sold off. Not by a lot, but about 0.75% today on May 1st. And like I say, it's not a lot, but it's a lot for China. It's probably the biggest down move that China's currency's had since the middle of March. And so some people think that this is the Chinese signaling their displeasure with the U.S. conversation. I'm not so convinced. Emerging markets are down. If I was at a hedge fund and I saw this headline come across, it was a Washington Post story, I know China's going to be closed for a while. I think that's like an interesting event type trade. Headline comes across, this is not good for the RMB. Either China purposely lets it fall, or as a consequence that the RMB falls. And so I'm not so sure that one needs to assume that the central bank, the Chinese officials are behind it. But it's clearly the direction that the market took the RMB in. And again, this is the offshore RMB.
Okay, but this is a very interesting story, just in, as you said, the fact that it is being mentioned. But do you see, no matter how these currencies move, if the country does go through with something like this, do you see it impacting at all the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Oh, yeah, I think this would be, this is sort of the mechanics of it. You know, China has a debt of ours, so it's got a particular treasury bond that it owns. How is it possible to just default against China, even if we wanted to? You know, there's billions of dollars of a particular issue that China's bought. Can we just default against on who owns it, or do we have to default on the issue itself? And so I think that, you know, it really reminds me of how the whole euro dollar market, the offshore U.S. dollar market, began. In the late 50s, there was a Suez crisis. And that is, make a long story short, Russians had deposits at U.S. banks, didn't like the way we treated our allies, Britain and France. And so what they did was they took their dollars because they were afraid of being frozen in the U.S. And so the Russians took their dollars from deposit in the U.S., U.S. banks, to British merchant banks. And now these British merchant banks had dollars they could lend. They were not capped. The interest rate wasn't capped by U.S. domestic rules. The beginnings of the offshore dollar market is the Russians, not capitalist development, it's a communist development to avoid the possible punishments the U.S. can inflict on them. And so if you were to tell me that the U.S. would go forward with this strategy of defaulting, and somehow figuring out how to default just on China, not everybody else. Everybody else would get scared that this is like a Pandora box. When you open it, I think that even if you question it, I think that the credibility of the U.S., the reputational risk of the U.S. is very great. I think it gives people even greater encouragement to look for an alternative.
Do you see an alternative out there then?
That's the problem.
Yeah,
there's really not. But what countries could do, because it's not necessarily an all or nothing kind of proposition. So, for example, foreign central banks have, and this is from the IMF's data, COFER, which is COFER. You could Google that and find that the IMF keeps track of the composition of most of the central banks' reserves. And the central banks as a whole, as a universe, have about 62 to say 65% of their currencies and their reserves in dollar instruments. Over time, because there's not such a clear alternative, over time, central banks can just reduce that 50% and share that other 50% with euro, sterling, which now that's going to leave the EU, the currency might become more decoupled from the euro. So you might see an increase in other currencies. That's the idea. We can go from what's the alternative? And the alternative is going from a largely unipolar world in reserves, where the U.S. dollar dominates, to a multipolar world.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's something we've talked about where there is the potential of just other currencies starting to have a bit more, I guess, weight in the world. It's a tough and very difficult discussion because, well, we just don't know how it could all play out. But when it comes to the funding of the U.S., then I think the argument has been that China has been more or less stepping back from some of their purchases of government treasuries in the U.S. So let's say that the U.S. does continue to threaten not paying this debt. Does it impact the U.S.'s ability to be able to continue to fund the treasuries?
I think that's an interesting thing because, you know, the day that the May 1st, when the offshore yuan gets hit, you say, well, what would be the effect on U.S. Treasuries? Well, we've had a stock market that's hit now for the second day in a row, and that's putting a bid underneath the Treasuries, pushing yields down a little bit. So I'd say there's no effect in the Treasury market from this, say, from playing with matches. But for the Chinese, though, I mean, sort of like in for a pound, or in for a penny, in for a pound, it is true that back in 2014, they had almost $1.3 trillion in treasuries. And that's about the peak, was around $1.3 trillion. And now they have about almost $1.1 trillion. So it seems to me that they're not accumulating more dollars, but they're sort of maintaining more or less what they have.
So then what does that mean for the U.S. if China isn't a net buyer?
Well, in the short run, I don't think it really means anything because we have another big buyer called the Federal Reserve. And, you know, there's a lot of people who think that the Federal Reserve is the reason why yields are low in the U.S. And I wonder if the Federal Reserve were to step away and say, you know, libertarians out there are right. We've encroached on the markets too much. Let's pull back from all of our functions. Interest rates, I think, would be much lower. Like we saw back in February, in the middle of March, when it looked like we were at the end of days, so to speak, the U.S. 10-year yield fell to 31 basis points. Today we're at around 60. So I think if the Federal Reserve were to really step away, we'd go back down and test those lows. Not that it's likely to happen, but there's all like a long way to explain, I think, that if China steps away, yields in the U.S. are so low already. It doesn't look like we're having any problems placing our treasury bonds, and we're raising a lot of them, of course, as you know, because of the large deficit. It doesn't seem like we have any problems, including that the Federal Reserve is right there buying. Though they've slowed down their buying, you know, at its peak, the Fed was buying $75 billion worth of treasuries a day. And now it's come down to $50 billion a week. So we've seen a real dramatic decline, but yields are still stable. Sort of not much above 50 basis points.
So, Mark, in summary, then, it doesn't sound like you think that the Fed will, or the U.S. will actually default on some of this debt that is owed to China because of the complexities of, well, who else holds it. How important do you think this story is in terms of moving forward in confidence in the U.S., but then also this U.S.-China battle that seems never ending?
Yes, I do think that China, in many ways, I think China is still trying to project its influence and power in the world, and so is the United States. And I think there's like a natural tension. But at the same time, I think that the market is, I think not only investors, but other policymakers have given U.S. President Trump a wide berth. He's going to talk about the dollar and talk about trade in a way that if other foreign leaders did, it really like caused an uproar. So they're giving Trump, I think, a wide berth. I think that it really depends on what happens in the elections in the U.S. If they have to give him wide berth for another 4 years, I think it becomes more of a more like semi-permanent type of arrangement rather than just a one-off, off-the-cuff type comments.
Okay. Well, Mark, we're going to wrap it up there. Some interesting comments, and really this story just is so new. We don't know how it's going to play out, but yeah, I think it does add some ammo to those people saying, well, this currency system that we are in and the amount of debt that is being carried, it can all be vanished. This thing can really start to snowball here if it does get out of hand. But again, this is just early on. Just wanted to share really that development from this week with everybody out there. Mark, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're wrapping up the first hour with a company update from GR Silver Mining. I'm chatting with the president and CEO, Marcio Fonseca. GR Silver Mining is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GRSL and on the OTCQB under the symbol GRSLF. Now, Marcio, because this is the first time that I am bringing you and GR Silver Mining onto the weekend show, I want to provide a quick little background. So the company's strategy, you're focused in Mexico, in the Rosario Mining District. You started with the San Marcial property. You used some past work, some past drill holes to generate a resource that was released at the beginning of 2019. This resource came in almost at 50 million ounces of silver equivalent. Throughout 2019, you were exploring some of the new targets at San Marcial. And then just recently, there was some pretty important news that all started at, I believe it was the beginning of March, and it came to an acquisition of the Plomosas project. Now, this is very close, pretty much adjacent to the San Marcial project. So still in the Rosario Mining District, you acquired the Plomosas project from First Majestic. It was one of their non-core assets, but there's a lot of historical work, much like the San Marcial project that you are currently going through. Can you please just give us a little synopsis of the strategy of GR Silver Mining and how you continue to work with some of this old data to build resources?
For sure. Thanks, Corey, for having me here. The strategy of the company has been from the beginning to acquire at low cost more resource advanced stage, developing stage projects, taking advantage of where the market was, or opportunities that would provide synergies with our existing portfolio in the Rosario Mining District. That's one of the most famous mining districts in Mexico for silver and gold. Going to your point about how we are dealing and investigating, validating the drill holes, and using that information as a support for upcoming resource estimation in six areas inside Plomosas. The way we have done all the work and validating all the data goes back to December when we signed a letter of intent to acquire the property from First Majestic when they invited us. We've been validating all the documentation, paper, digital, asset certificates, reports, and today we believe that we have two groups of drill holes in that project. One-third, it's not from this year, but it's very recent. It's one-third was drilled by First Majestic from 2016 to 2018 with all the QAQC chain of custody and documentation, which make us comfortable to say that they are fully compliant to support a resource estimation. The other two-thirds was drilled by Grupo Mexico until 2001. And we have most of the documentation that proves the existence of those holes, and you are validating the location of the collars in the field. Most of them, of these two-thirds, we have the core, which you can go back in and validate as well. The First Majestic drill holes, we have all the core. So the idea is to release, as we validate each set of holes at each one of these six areas, and for the first time, show to the public the multiple veins, different structures, not only lead and zinc, that the history of the project was on a lead and zinc small mine, but also kilos of silver and tens of gold grades in different veins that we are discovering that will form the basis for the resource and estimation of a multiple vein system, not just one vein, probably five, three, four veins in each one of these areas on a strike length probably 500 meters or more. That's what we're working.
Okay, so just a little one more note here is that you do have over almost 600 historic drill holes from First Majestic and Grupo Mexico that you are intending on sampling and releasing to the market. Some of the recent news, though, has come from a couple of the different zones, a total of six priority zones you have outlined. We've seen some high-grade silver, and just recently, on April 23rd, we got some results of higher-grade gold intercepts, too. What can you share with us in terms of, so far, what these results have shown you?
So the results are showing us that it's very important to have all the drill data in a 3D model, because another point for the audience is that nobody has ever put all these 583 drill holes in a 3D model. Nobody has ever done a resource estimation for this area. So when you look in a 3D model, you can really connect the dots and start to separate the veins. And we have identified that now we have two different types of mineralization at Plomosas. One is the traditional polymetallic breccia that has 2-3% zinc and lead, 350 grams, 400 grams proton silver, 1-2 grams proton gold. But we also have the 1,000, 2,000, or even more grams proton of silver, 10, 20, and we had a news release of 70 grams proton of gold in one interval. They are completely different because the polymetallic lead and zinc is more on a breccia 45 degree angle fault. The silver and gold is more on a steeper fault that's 80 degrees in a completely separate geological setting.
So what will the overall plan at Plomosas be? Understanding that you still have a lot of this core that you can sample, but will there be a strategy to get some drills on site?
So as we are moving in a more advanced stage to validate and have everything 3D, we are likely to bring external engineers, qualified people to start working on how we can approach to start doing some basic resource estimation in each one of these six areas. The first one that we are going to look at is the San Juan, which we released on April 13th, 3.5 meters with 1,400 grams per ton of silver and probably close to 15 grams per ton of gold. And inside that interval, we had 70 centimeters at 6,000 grams per ton of silver and 70 grams per ton of gold. The external engineer might require some drill holes just to put some to validate some zones. That's why you might bring some external drill rigs to do some work. The second area would be Plomosas around the mine. And the other ones, the other four areas, probably next year. The San Juan, we expect to have the resource before December. And you try to be aggressive and have the Plomosas as well. But the first one is the San Juan.
Okay, so you're going to be releasing individual resources focused on each of these areas then?
That's the strategy. They are not connected, they are parallel. So each one is a different area for multiple sets of veins. For example, San Juan, if you look at the news release on April 13th, there's a cross-section that we have four steep faults that might carry the silver and gold, and one shallow dipping fault that carries the polymetallic.
Okay, so treating them all as different deposits, but again, you still have all these drill holes that you get to release to the market, so it keeps costs low for the company, especially when you don't have a drill or don't need a drill on site. Now, what kind of work can you be undertaking during this time that Mexico is under a bit of a shutdown? I understand that mining activities can continue in Mexico, but there are a number of mines that have been postponed. But in terms of exploration work, what can the company do?
We are in a particular situation that we do not fit in a scenario where we would have hundreds of employees, a lot of expats fly in, fly out. We are a base of field workers and geologists where most of them are from the local cities nearby, like 20, 30 kilometers. And so the field workers are still working in the field because we are respecting social distance, one or two by group of them and with distance. We have three drill rigs, two portable and one medium size, operating at San Marcial. Why? Because we made an acquisition of these drill rigs early in the year with the finance that we completed last year, aiming to reduce the cost of drilling. And we are drilling shallow holes in a main portable drill rig in the San Marcial area, in the 8 targets that we have there. That's another project nearby Plomosas, drilling probably shallow holes 20, 30 meters deep, testing some veins. And also we have the other drill rig, that's the medium size, drilling some areas of 150 meters long drill holes. We can do that because we brought an experienced driller to train local employees, supporting the employment in the local communities and giving them opportunity to work and get training to be drillers.
Okay, so future news flow here. We will continue to see results out of Plumosa's, but San Marcial, you are still working on at least testing out some of these targets there as well. And remember, San Marcial is the one with the resource you came out at the beginning of 2019. So news that will continue. Marcio, can you update all of our listeners on the cash that is in the bank for the company, please?
Right now, we are below the 2 million, a little bit below that. And that money was raised for the full purpose to fund the exploration at San Marcial. It was a financing that was completed in November last year. And as you said at the beginning of this interview, the Plumosa's was acquired last month. So although we have all these drill holes at some stage, some drilling is required, and we are discussing with some shareholders how we are going to evolve on this. But we have cash for to fully fund San Marcial and a little bit of the work at Plumosa's for the upcoming months.
Okay, one final comment. The company shares outstanding as of the end of March was just under 86 million. Fully diluted basis, 97 million. Some strong shareholders too. First Majestic through that deal to acquire Plumosa's. They hold 19.9%. You also have SSR Mining as a shareholder, JDS Mining, Sandstorm Gold. They all hold different percentages. I will post a link to the company presentation on this weekend show posting, so everybody can go through that presentation, and please email me with any other questions you have for Marcio, and quite frankly, any other questions or comments you want from any of the guests that I have featured on this weekend show. In full disclosure, I am a shareholder of GR Silver Mining. Everybody, hey, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope everybody is safe and trying to make the best of being really stuck at home through that whole month of April and now turning the corner into May. I've appreciated all the emails I've been getting, everybody tuning in to our webinars and tuning in day after day, sharing all of your thoughts. Marcio, appreciate your time this weekend. Everybody, have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you, Corey.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.